And we're live. Well, welcome to the roundtable for 821. My apologies for not doing a sit rep on Monday night. I was traveling and worked late on Monday. Didn't have time to sit down and actually record. Got a lot to talk about today. We're going to start off. We've got a lot to pack into an hour and a half. So we'll get started. We're going to start with travel security. Let Chris kick this off and we'll start there. It's all yours, Chris.
All right. Well, let's jump into it. So I'm just going to slice off a little piece of this as far as dealing with vehicles. I get this question a lot, and I know Matt, you get this question a lot. You know, how are things going to change when the shit hits the fan, when we're in a, you know, without rule of law situation? Arguably, we're sliding into that. I don't even like the moniker of shit hit the fan, because I think it hit the fan a long time ago, and it's just a steady stream of it, and it's just increasing. So there's going to be issues with going to get groceries, if groceries are even to be had anywhere. There's going to be issues with going to pick up a colleague, going to see the kids, going to help somebody, you know, with a project, whatever. So I'm going to kind of overlay the way I was doing stuff overseas, because it's a pretty good model for, you know, what we may see here, especially because it's not designed around an overt model. And, you know, it pains me to have people continually tell me that, you know, when this occurs, they're going to roll heavy in a gun truck and be all camoed up and kitted out. It's like you're going to be a huge target, and you're just going to get eliminated and pulled off the board.
Murphy's law of combat: don't look conspicuous, it draws fire.
don't be the nail that's sticking up in a world full of hammers, right? And the world will be full of hammers. So I'm just going to kind of break this down real quick, just some basic TTPs. And I know each of you guys on here are familiar with this stuff too, so jump in as you see fit. First and foremost, a movement plan. So similar to like an operations order. It doesn't have to be that extensive, but you have to have some kind of plan, okay? Even if it's just going from, you know, my house here, 40 miles to see the grandparents, something like that. My recommended model, as things get worse, is that if you have the logistics for it, you move with two vehicles as much as possible, okay? Because you can be mutually supporting, okay? So that gives you a main and a secondary. You know, if you've got a lot of people, you got a lot of vehicles, having somebody as a CAT team, a counter assault element, basically hanging in the rear, it's kind of like bringing a QRF with you. That would be cool. But just as a basic guideline, rolling with two is recommended. All right.
Yeah, most people won't have that to begin with. So,
all right. But, you know, people are going to cluster together. If they don't, they're not going to survive. So, I mean, that's going to occur, or they're not going to make it. The onesie and twosie fantasies, it's not going to happen. So a couple of things, as far as the vehicle itself, we got to keep the vehicle rolling, right? So I have a bag that I have in all my vehicles that is a vehicle support kit. Okay. Only thing that goes in that is stuff to keep the vehicle alive and humming. Okay. And to get it recovered and keep it moving. So a lot of you already have stuff like this, you know, hopefully you've got patch kits for your tires. You've got inflators, you've got a pump. You know, you've got, you know, basic tools to make basic repairs, spare fuses, stuff like that. Just some random ideas I'll throw out there just from my experience. High pressure hose tape. This is something you can pick up at the auto parts store. High pressure hose tape and some old school hose clamps. You'd be amazed at what you can fix with that. Okay. And if you blow a hose, you're screwed. So just having that little bit of tape that can save your ass. There's a compound out there that JB Weld makes called a steel stick. and it's basically a putty. You mash it up, and I can patch a shot fuel tank. I can patch any of my various receptacles that are holding the fluids necessary for my vehicle to function.
Yeah. Radiators.
Yeah, Brackett talked about that months ago. I remember he did some JB.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, this stuff's out there. It's cheap. It's accessible. It's accessible now. It might not be accessible later. So spend a couple bucks on it. Spare fluids, it's kind of a no-brainer. Basic recovery tools, a snatch strap, a tow strap. Know the difference and know how to use them. A come-along or a winching system. A come-along will get you out of a lot of trouble. It's helped me many times in the past. And I mean, you could go crazy with it, but that's like really, really, really basic stuff. Another bag I have in the vehicle always is an operator support kit. Okay. So not for the vehicle, that's for the dudes in the vehicle. So that goes with us if we leave the vehicle.
What's an operator support kit for those of us who don't know what that is?
So that's just going to support the human beings in the vehicle.
So it's not a bug out bag. It's a,
you could call it a bug out bag if you want, but for me, it lives in the vehicle and it has some basic items such as smoke. I'm a big fan of smoke. I have lots of smoke grenades in the vehicle and in the operator support kit bag, extra ammo.
I'm asking you questions I know I'm going to get, so just bear with me. Right. So where would one get smoke grenades if they didn't know where to get them?
So believe it or not, the easy way to get them is the airsoft community. The airsofters have smoke grenades. Enola Gay is a popular brand. The EG, I believe the 18X, correct me if I'm wrong there, Matt. I think it's the 18X, it puts out the same cloud volume as a mil-spec smoke grenade. So those work really good. I was actually signing in
so that I could link over to some of the stuff. Yeah,
I'm looking it up while you're talking. I've got the Enola Gay stuff up. I'll post it just a second here.
Yeah.
Just keep going, because I'm posting this stuff as you're saying it.
The ATF has made noises about trying to get these pyrotechnics off the street, so to speak. So get them sooner rather than later as far as bangs, distraction devices, and smoke. Smoke, I think, being more important. Because we're using smoke as an obscurant. In other words, if I look at it just from an infantryman's point of view, my basics of security is going to be cover, concealment, and speed, right? So I'm going to plug those in somewhere into whatever my situation is. If I don't have cover, if I'm caught in the open, it would be great if I had portable concealment with me, and that's what smoke is. It's concealment you can carry in a pouch or in a pocket. So you get those out there, and at least an enemy can't put a crosshair on you. They've just got to fire indiscriminately. So not perfect, but it does give you huge benefit. It's saved my life more than a couple times. So as far as an obscurant, get the purple smoke. The purple smoke is the thickest as far as the Enola Gay. It's very, very thick. And then also have a couple colored ones, because this can go back to your SOI, your signal operating instructions, so part of your comms plan. I want to have some kind of non-technological means of signaling. So flares, smoke, things like that, colored panels. And I think Matt can speak a lot broader on that than I can. Going back to my operator support bag, water, some kind of filter, whether it's a Life Straw, Grail, Katadyn, batteries for all my equipment, some kind of breach kit. Okay. Now, I've been talking earlier on X about breach kits, and I brought up the quick saws and stuff like that. Those are great, and that's kind of a mission-specific item. But what I do keep in my rig is a small bag of Milwaukee 12-volt tools. I've got a cutoff saw, I've got a hammer drill, and I've got an impact tool.
These are battery, correct?
Yes, battery powered. So, you know, I can get through locks. I can get through a lot of stuff with those if I need to. it's not something I'm going to take for like a specific mission, you know, where I'm going to do a mechanical breach on a steel door or something like that. I'm just talking about stuff that's just kind of lives in my rig because it can solve a lot of little problems for me. Okay. One thing I learned the hard way to keep in my rig is a battery powered chainsaw. The technology's gotten really good on these battery powered tools. Guys, do yourself a favor. If you're just going to get one big ticket item, get yourself a quality battery powered chainsaw, because it can ruin your day if you're up in a mountain road somewhere and, you know, you get treed in, or, you know, you, God forbid, you've got to extract somebody from under a tree or something.
But just something that doesn't, will never need batteries, your basic triangular Sven saw with a sharp blade, that thing will tear through a 12 inch pretty quick. And it doesn't take any room in your trunk. Buy several of them and put them everywhere.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. Along with that, just the basic recovery kits that, you know, we had on Humvees back in the day, the shovel and the pickaxe. You know, some kind of shovel, doesn't have to be the military ones. Some kind of shovel system, some kind of pickaxe or something like that.
You can buy shovels at Home Depot that are, they'll fit in the back of your truck, that are, you know, good for everybody.
Yeah, on that line, I've been stuck in the mud a few times, and I've learned to just carry a couple of random pieces of like plywood and other lumber to like put under a jack if there's just no hard ground to put a jack on.
Yeah.
Or to wedge underneath of a tire that's just not getting a grip.
Yep.
I got like random lumber in the back of the vehicles now for them.
Yeah, so I want to add a few things here, not to steal a show or anything, but vehicle selection in and of itself is something that I think it gets a lot of attention. There was a comment in the chat section that, you know, I think it needs attention. A guy was commenting on seeing a Hilux. And, you know, in South Carolina or wherever it was, you know, hey, that's all good and well. The reason the Hilux has the following that it has is because, you know, it basically it can operate very reliably with a lack of maintenance, right? It's kind of, you know, what we would back in the day would call all of them were just basically technicals, or non-tactical vehicles, NTVs, right? So, all right, whatever. Like, let's just sidestep all that, you know, the nostalgia or whatever. Let's talk about actual vehicle selection. So, the vehicles that I own, that I have owned for a long period of time now, the vehicles that I saw growing up, and, you know, new vehicles that I have either purchased or will purchase, you know, in the future. How do you select what you're going to buy and why? So the first thing is that the vehicle needs some sort of ground clearance. And this could be, you know, like Subarus. I hate to bring it up because, you know, obviously I'm not a lesbian Presbyterian priest or whatever. But, you know, Subarus, they are what they are. Like they have the following they have for a reason, because they are very reliable vehicles, and, you know, they developed that following for decades for a reason.
Yeah.
So you need a little bit of ground clearance. You know, I'm not saying that you need to go out and have, you know, like a fucking jacked up Florida rig where like you're driving through the Everglades or something. You don't necessarily need a, you know, a monster truck, because that comes with a lot of problems. If you're running tires, and this is something I learned growing up, by the way. If you're running tires larger than 35s, 35 inches in height, you're going to break things on your vehicles. I'm just telling you, like Northern North Carolina, Southern Virginia, growing up in the hills, you know, good old boys, everybody's jacking up everything. You know, I learned the hard way, putting a giant lift kit under a Jeep Cherokee, and not and thinking that was like where it was going to stop. And all of a sudden you're snapping axles and, you know, you're ripping the transmission out and, you know, differentials, everything else. Like, here's the deal. If you're not hardcore into four-wheeling, and that's fine. You don't need to be to have a vehicle that is capable, right, for things. Baseline, you need some ground clearance. You need enough pound feet of torque to get out of a situation, the low end torque. It's not horsepower necessarily that you need to look at, but torque, because that is where it, and look at how your vehicle is geared. What is the first gear running gear? What is the gear ratio on that? Anything less than 3.73, that's not low enough. Okay. 3.73 is kind of the 3.73 gears in the rear end. It's kind of the entry level of towing capability in half ton trucks. So that's really where you need to start looking. Toyotas generally run those stock. I know Nissan Frontiers were for a little while. I don't know what it is now. I would imagine it's somewhere right around in there. But you need to pay attention to that. The next thing. You know, you don't necessarily need gigantic tires on a vehicle. Just make sure that you can maintain an adequate speed, because when you start going with bigger tires under stuff, it comes with all sorts of other problems, keeping them balanced, keeping them aligned, and premature wear on drive lines, premature wear on wheel bearings is a real big deal. I can tell you for a fact that on a mid-2000 Super Duty, when you have a front end wheel bearing go out, it will literally throw you out of the road. I had that happen. So I know. But make sure with tires and all that, like your tires are serviceable, you know, take a penny, put it in the tire. This is kind of the old school tire tread test. Once it is no longer covering half of Lincoln's head, then it's time to get new tires. Now, that test will obviously pass your tires. Also, by the way, they have wear bars in them in the treads that tells you how much tread life you have left. That's all good and well, but I want the maximum amount of tread because I need the maximum amount of leading edge on my tires. On my trucks, I run all terrain tires that are very aggressive. I'm a big fan of the Maxxis tires. BF Goodrich is really good as well. Goodyear makes a pretty decent all-terrain on a lot of newer stock vehicles because they've got contracts to do it. But Maxxis is the brand that I'm really going to throw out there, and Cooper is another one. If you want a really great American-made option made, you know, down in Texas in El Paso, by the way, Cooper is a really good brand. But you know, tires, you definitely want the maximum amount of leading edge and you want the maximum amount of tread left on them, because that gives you everything, right? That gives you everything you're looking for. The grip on the road is very, very important. And the more grip you have on the pavement, the more grip you're going to have off-road as well. Not only that, tow hooks. You need to have tow hooks on a vehicle. I'm going to give a little anecdotal story here from a little over a year ago. A buddy of mine, we'll just call him Madman Actual. That's his screen name. It's where he puts content out under over on American Partisan. He worked for the NSA, and I'll just leave it at that. Great guy. You want to talk SIGINT? He's the guy you want to talk to about signals intelligence. I wrote the book on it, but he's the dude that has done it all and taught it, by the way, in the schoolhouse. But he was teaching a class for me at my place, and I had a neighbor who had some challenges, some substance abuse challenges, who it was after midnight. We're all about to bed down. You know, we've had a great day of training. We had a big class. It was like 20 people in this class. Really, really good time. and we're all hanging out. We're all, you know, it's done deal. Well, all of a sudden, the neighbor who had wrecked her car and turned it up on its side in the ditch is coming by to get help. You know, basically she didn't have any money for a tow truck. She obviously is, you know, impaired, and she's looking for somebody to pull her car out. Well, the problem was is that she's got a really cheap vehicle that she's driving in. You know, entry level car. You know, just whatever. All of the brands have these. And you got to understand, when you're buying an entry level vehicle, doesn't matter what the make and model is, you're giving up certain design features in them. And one of them is tow hooks. You need to make sure that you have tow hooks front and rear on a vehicle. If you don't have tow hooks as part of the vehicle's design, and in particular, they need to be exposed tow hooks, you're going to have problems. You know, I didn't know what vehicle she had. I mean, I knew what she drove, but it was late at night, so I fired the tractor up and, you know, take it out to where she is turned over on her side, or on the vehicle's on its side. And I can't pull her out. Like, I could, obviously, a 60 horsepower Massey Ferguson is going to pull anything out, right? But I could not pull her out because I would have to hook to her frame with my, I've got some Striker cables. I'd have to hook to her frame, and it's literally going to rip the crumble zones on her car apart, right? Because that's the way that small passenger cars are designed. They're not designed for recovery. They're not designed for hard use. They're designed to carry you from A to B. And if you get into a wreck from A to B, to satisfy the NTSB's safety requirements, right? So told her straight out, like, hey, you know, can't pull you out. This is just what it is, right? Every vehicle that I own has exposed tow hooks. The Super Duties that I've got have tow hooks out the front. They've got tow hooks out the rear. You know, in addition to the Reese hitch that's on there, right? So your hitch point, which is attached to the frame, that's yet another one. You know.
Wait, Matt. I can't just throw a trailer ball under the radiator and drag it out?
Not going to work, right? Not going to work. And there are things that you can do to upgrade the capabilities of your vehicle. Like, for example, you know, one of the best selling vehicles in America right now is a half ton pickup truck, right? Whether that's an F-150 or a Chevy Silverado 1500 or, you know, a Dodge 1500, they're all half ton trucks, right? But we've kind of got into the point here where the half-ton truck, because it's so ubiquitous, has now been designed with crumble zones and, you know, all these safety requirements. You need to figure out what those are in the design, because if it doesn't have exposed tow hooks, then it has crumble zones that are designed into the vehicle itself. That doesn't lend itself very well to recovering vehicles or really, you know, playing bumper cars. We'll just, you know, make it nice and say playing bumper cars. You know, maybe doing a vehicle breach on something or running through things, you know. Never done it, have seen it in the movies, so we'll just but it's just one of those things. You know, my Super Duties that I have, you know, and a Chevy HD as well, they all have exposed tow hooks, and they're all diesel, right? Yeah, I know it's expensive, okay? Before anybody comments in here, oh, my God, that's so expensive. Yeah, I get it. Believe me, I paid for it. I understand. I've been running vehicles like this for most of my life, growing up in, you know, doing the business end of agriculture and then going into the military and, you know, what I'm doing is sharing this with you. Can you get away with gas trucks? Sure. Absolutely. But you need vehicles with a little bit of weight. Very good friend of mine, somebody who's been in a bunch of classes, and I've run a bunch of classes for them down in South Texas, calls the Ford Super Duty the South Texas Technical. And I think, like, I get a good chuckle out of it because that is really funny.
He's not wrong. He's not wrong.
Cartel technical, you know. But there's a reason for that. It's just like, you know, when you go to the Middle East, you see a Toyota Hilux everywhere. There's a reason for that. Because they're durable vehicles that stand up to a lot of abuse and stand up to those mission requirements. And they're common in a working environment. It's the same with a Ford Super Duty. It's the same with, you know, a Chevy HD. Same with, you know, a 3/4-ton Dodge. It has those features that are built into it for a reason. And that's why they're highly susceptible to, or highly applicable, rather, to those uses. And those are the vehicles you need to be looking at.
Just as an aside, not to mention that stored diesel fuel will outlast gasoline by multiple years.
Yeah, big time. Hey, just to continue my list here real quick. So we got a vehicle support kit. You want to have that in all your rigs, operator support kit. And then what I call an OTHA, which is over the horizon awareness kit. Okay. And so what this is going to entail is a radar detector. So a directional radar detector. So something like a unit in R7 or an R8. And it has less to do about preventing tickets as far as just literally over the horizon awareness. Okay. A home patrol 2 scanner or something similar, something with a close call feature, something that you can GPS into as you're traveling, because it's going to pick up the local traffic. That way you don't have to keep punching in new zip codes as you're driving. A CB is a underutilized, underappreciated piece of kit. I like keeping a tiny SA in the rig, just for lack of a better term, bug sweeping.
What's SA?
I was just going to ask that, Matt.
A spectrum analyzer, and Matt can expound on that. A BLE scanner, which is just app-driven, so this could be on an old phone or a tablet. And this one's actually pretty crucial, and we do it in one of my courses. A lot of the tracking tags that are employed these days use Bluetooth or BLE, Bluetooth low energy modules. And so
you could sniff them easy.
You can sniff them out.
Need something to sniff them with.
Yep. And then, of course,
let me touch on that real quick, Chris, because that's a very, very salient point. If you have a 2015 or newer car, somewhere on that car is a chip, and somewhere on that car, it's emitting a low frequency. And I'm not talking low jack, I'm talking Bluetooth. And they what they normally do is they'll broadcast across whatever. Nowadays, it's broadcast across the wireless in the car. So even if you turn off the wireless, it's still beaconing low emission Bluetooth. But you want to have something to sniff that. And those sniffers are only like $20 on Amazon. It's worth the money. Couple AA batteries in that sitting in your car. It will save your life. Sorry, Chris. Go ahead.
And the vehicle tech piece is kind of a show unto itself. So I'm not going to go down that rabbit trail because it's kind of a nightmare. But if you can stay pre-2010, you're going to be in much better shape. I'll leave it at that as far as the technical issues.
Yeah, the older, the better. And here's another thing too. If you have something that's from the 60s or 70s, you can run aviation fuel in that. Like 100 low lead never goes bad. In fact, one of the old tricks of the trade for some of those old cars is if somebody's going to put their car in long-term storage, they throw aviation fuel in it because it never goes bad. And you could literally start it right up after 10, 15 years, put a battery in it, and away you go. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the reason why I have old vehicles is for that reason. And it may not seem like that those vehicles have capability, but the other thing about something that's from the 60s and 70s is that they're made out of real steel. Steel is real, mm-hmm. and it gives you some extra punch. Whereas my new Bronco, it's basically built to crumple. In fact, it's a Pinto. And it's lightweight doors, lightweight metal. It's enough to wrap around you so they can pick you up and drop you in a hole. And you have to run current gas in it. You can't run anything that would eat up that catalytic converter. So you have to think through all those pieces when you're talking about old vehicles. And the other thing about old vehicles, too, is that everything's right there. You pop the hood open, you can reach everything. You don't have to dig through stuff to get to it. You don't have to take off covers. So you trade some utility for that vehicle, but I guarantee you, you'll be able to find parts. You'll be able to go different places in it, and you'll be able to run different types of fuel in it.
And you can trace a wire from end to end. It doesn't go through three different computer modules.
It's all right.
You can't fix.
Yeah.
So that's where getting an HD truck comes in, because if you're getting half ton and below, they're designing it with those crumble zones. A three-quarter ton truck, even the current production ones, are not necessarily exempt from safety standards, but they have an exception made for them because they have a different use.
Commercial.
The intended use by them. They're not passenger vehicles. They're intended to be commercial vehicles just based on their weight, right? So, you know, I have a couple of mid 2000s Super Duties, right? They both weigh 10,000 pounds. That is the maximum amount of allowable highway passenger weight that you can have in a vehicle. So you have to put commercial tags on them because, at least in the state of North Carolina. So because you have to do that, you have to put weighted tags on them. They have an exemption to them. That is the reason I'm telling you, three-quarter ton trucks or higher, that's really what you want to look for. You know, like so the auto industry is susceptible to fads, just like everything else, you know, literally everything under the sun. And the fad right now is off-road vehicles, like the overlanding stuff, the nostalgia for, you know, the 70s and 80s style Broncos and Blazers is like at a fever pitch. 10 years ago, it was for muscle cars, right? So you had the Challengers and the Mustangs and everything. Now it's for the off-road vehicles. So literally all the companies are offering a off-road special package. That's all good and well, because what that does is that gives you that more higher ground clearance. But you're not getting, especially in the half tons, you're not getting any better build quality out of it. I can tell you right now, I've got a buddy that bought a brand new Raptor. Right, got a brand new Raptor, gorgeous truck, white, got the black racing stripes and shit on it, right? Really, really nice vehicle, huge tires, like it's built for off-roading. Cool, like sweet. But when you start to look at the actual design of it, the bumpers are made to crumble. You know, the rear bumper is made to crumble on that thing. The bed is designed to shrink like an accordion if it gets hit from the rear. HD trucks are you know, three-quarter ton vehicles that are on any lot right now. They don't do that. They're exempted from those safety standards. They have an exception that's made for them. And so you're going to see box steel frames. They have a whole different. This is why Chevrolet, by the way, Chevrolet has a package for their three-quarter ton trucks that's out that has fully box steel bumpers front and rear on it, the AEV package. They call it the Bison package. That it exposed tow hooks, front and rear, it's a hell of a truck, you know, just a hell of a truck. So it's something to think about, survivability from impacts. You know, the Bronco is not the new Ford Bronco is not designed for that. It's designed for people that are wanting to go, you know, explore the deserts of New Mexico. Like, you know, all right, cool. That's, you know, the Jeep crowd. That's cool. You know, really, really awesome. But that's its use case. It's not designed for anything outside of that.
Nope. And it's got its Achilles heels. I mean, there's more than just light metal. It's got other Achilles heels to it too. And, you know, I'm a Ford guy. And I can tell you that the thing I like about the old Bronco versus the new one is it's kind of like a Volkswagen, right? You're never quite in control, which is always entertaining. But anyway, let's.
That's true. I've never.
It is true. I'm telling you, man. It's like a Volkswagen. You're never quite in control of the damn thing, and it's, you know, it floats around and it does all kinds of high speed stuff. But the interesting thing about some of the older vehicles, because I've owned old Internationals, I've owned old Dodges, old Chevys, and what's interesting is that all of them have their quirks, but the one thing that you can do with those that you can't do with the new stuff is you can literally replace anything on the road. I mean, anything. You can get under it and do whatever you need to do and keep going. And at the end of the day, that may be the thing that saves your life. It won't be, you know, having all the high-tech stuff. It may just be able to swap a part and go quickly. So I want to transition off of this. I know we're mid-topic. We'll come back to this next week. But I want to transition to this Houthi and sea lines of communication, because this is a big deal. Matt, I want to give you some time to talk. Bracken, I want to give you some time to talk to this.
It won't take that long.
And then I want to talk to strategic out of that, because there's some strategic that comes out of that. And Troop, I know you'll have a lot to add to that.
Yeah, before we go off of vehicles, I would just say, when you're with other people and you're teaching other people like tactical type of driving, my biggest pet peeve is people getting right up on the bumper of the car at the red light. Leave room so that you can hook out of there if you got to. You should always be able to, depending on your hood, should always be able to see some asphalt in front of your car. It'll save you from rear-ending somebody, which is always your fault. But more importantly, if shit goes sideways in traffic, you can use your vehicle as a weapon as long as you can swerve out of there. But if you're continually, not you, I mean, nobody on this video would do it, but like when you're teaching your kids to drive, when you're with friends, just say, dude, leave some space that you can hook out of there if you have to. You can't use your vehicle as a weapon if you're bumper to bumper in traffic. It's like a huge pet peeve of mine. Drives me crazy. And you can't go wrong with having more water than you think in your vehicle, things like that, because you can use it for your radiator, even if you're just pouring it into your busted radiator. But, or if you're stuck on the road and you're gonna wish you had a few gallons of potable water. I mean, just, it doesn't cost anything. Don't throw away the old Gatorade bottles. Fill them up, put them in a box, carry them around. Anyway, that's pretty much my notes on cars, such as they are. But yeah, I want to talk about the Houthis. Sal Mercoglio and Commander Salamander and some other people are talking about this, that the U.S. Navy is basically been beaten by the Houthis, and the comments are like showing such a level of basic ignorance that I thought it's worth expounding on. People are saying like, well, why are we, you know, why we can't send the Marines in there, or, you know, it's like the size of Texas, so no Marines. They're driving around in technicals. They're launching all size of drones, from little distraction drones to big truck mounted missiles, from a huge desert area. So you're not going to stop them that way. And the more important thing about this is it's not just the Red Sea. So the Red Sea throws a monkey wrench into the shipping of the whole world, adds friction to the Western world, America, the Five Eyes, Europe. Now they've got to go around Africa. So only friends of the Houthis are going to be able to go through the Red Sea. Everybody else has got to go around Africa. Why does that matter? Well, it takes more fuel, but it also means instead of making four or five trips a year, you're making three trips a year. So the ship's lives are shortened in terms of their useful, a ship with a 20-year life, it's made to make maybe, you know, 100 of those trips. Now it's going to only make 70 of those trips for carrying the same cargo. Okay, so big deal. The Red Sea, we'll figure it out. The point about the Houthis is not the Red Sea anymore. It's the whole world. And we don't have graphics to put up, or I would, but there's two names that I keep coming back to that everybody should be familiar with. And you can do homework and you look it up on the internet. But there's a guy named Admiral Thayer Mahan, M-A-H-A-N. Both of these dudes have unusual first names, so you'll look them up real easy. Thayer, T-H-A-Y-E-R, Thayer Mahan. When I was a ROTC midshipman, he was like one of the big people we had to study. We had to read his book and learn all about the importance of choke points and the sea lines of communication. So in 1890, he wrote something called The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. Every midshipman since then has read this book, committed it to memory almost. The other guy that I didn't hear of until more recently, also with a funny first name, is named Halford, like H-A-L-F-O-R-D, Mackinder, M-A-C-K-I-N-D-E-R. And in 1904, he wrote something called The Geographical Pivot of History. And guess what it's about? The importance of the Ukraine. This is before the Bolsheviks. This is when, in fairly recent history, like the last 50 years, the British and the French had fought the Russians in the Black Sea over Crimea. That had been like a pretty big world war in the 19th century, so to speak. And his theory has been called the Heartland Theory. So you'll see a big Eurasia map, and around it, you'll see the sea lines of communication. Before America became the world's big naval superpower, it was Great Britain. And Great Britain used to use an expression called the Great Game. The Great Game went back to like Napoleon and before, and it was always being the balancer so that nobody would take over at the time all of Europe. Like the Germans would never conquer all of Europe. The French would never conquer all of Europe. That Europe, that the Brits would always come in on the side of the Spanish, or you know, somebody to balance whoever was threatening to take over all of Europe, because the British thought that they would just definitely outpower Britain if one colossus, you know, ruled from Russia to Spain. They could never allow that. So the British Navy was made to keep the sea lanes of communication open for British trade, and to keep any other power from consolidating the Eurasian landmass. Now, we've actually seen this, and you can say that the Great Game has continued. Why did we take out, obviously we did, not Ukrainian divers, why did we take out the Nord Stream pipeline? It's to cut off German industry from cheap Russian gas, period. That's all it's about. If German industry is coupled with cheap, reliable German or Russian natural gas, too powerful. I mean, going back to the end of the Second World War, there was something called the Morgenthau Plan. They were going to like turn Germany into Carthage. Well, it took another 80 years, but we've done it. We're turning Germany into Carthage. America loved Germany when there was a Soviet Union because it helped balance, you know, NATO. It was a strong power, economic power within NATO to balance against the Soviet Union. Now we don't want Germany and Russia ever getting together. That's why we blew up the Nord Stream. Liquefied natural gas that has to come on a ship costs about 10 times more per unit of energy. And not only that, it's much more vulnerable because in Texas or Louisiana, you've got to build a gasification or a liquefaction plant. And then in Spain or Portugal or Germany, you got to build a gasification plant. These plants cost billions of dollars and decades to build, but a missile can take them out. So what am I getting at? Our power over the sea lanes of communication is coming to an end, folks. It's ending. When Teddy Roosevelt set the Great White Fleet around the world at the turn of the last century, no sampan was going to come out and fire on a dreadnought. You know, that if you were a tier one naval power, whether it was the Russians, the Japanese, I mean, the Russians went all the way around, fought the Japanese, got their butts kicked, but they did prove they had a blue water capability. The French, the British, no Vietnam or China was going to come out and attack a gunboat, you know, a destroyer. Just not going to happen. And that's been the predominance ever since the Second World War. American aircraft carriers, carrier battle groups, that's been the backbone of sea power. Just recently, we were rushing a carrier to the Eastern Med. It had to leave its escorts behind because they can't keep up. It had to just make a dash with just nuclear subs meeting it along the way for protection. No destroyers, no cruisers, because the carrier is so much faster. Well, all the paradigms that we've thought of since the Second World War are coming to an end, because now anybody in the equivalent of a damn sampan can play Houthi rebel anywhere, Straits of Malacca, any coastal area, any small ship capable of carrying a couple cargo containers can be carrying packaged missiles that can take out a ship. So the idea that it's going to be fleet versus fleet, or German U-boats versus American surface Navy, that kind of a conflict at sea is coming to an end. I mean, it could still happen. We could still have American convoys trying to get past Russian submarines. I'm not saying that's over, but we can't just say from now until the foreseeable future, we cannot say, oh, we absolutely guarantee the right of free passage from anywhere to anywhere. That's what the Houthis are showing us in the Red Sea. We can put aircraft carriers in there. All the air power we've got, we can forward deploy U.S. Air Force assets. We still can't keep these guys from firing missiles at ships. So what's that say about the rest of the world, where any small ship carrying a few cargo containers can pop off a missile? Are you going to search every small ship? Are you going to treat every small ship as hostile and say, oh, you must stay 100 miles away from any U.S. Navy warship? That can't happen. So the era of American sea lanes or sea power is coming to an end because of this weapons revolution. And what does that mean from the other point of view? The Mackinder heartland, the global island, the Eurasian superpower, Russia, China, Iran, all the stands, they have internal lines of communication. Our whole point since the Second World War was never let Russia and China become allied as an economic bloc. Do whatever you can diplomatically, keep those guys apart, because if they're ever pulled together, they're going to be a power that outweighs the West. And with Western sea power no longer able to, cudgel our way around the periphery, we're always going to be at a disadvantage. Anybody can take out our ships to shut down the sea lanes of communication. But when you have internal lines of communication, meaning railroad tracks, pipelines for oil, natural gas, electrical power lines, if you have across the land internal lines of communication, and let's say we're in a war, we fire a missile at a pipeline, we blow up a half a kilometer of pipeline, they fix it in a week. You take out an undersea pipeline or a fiber optic trunk under the Atlantic, it may take months or never to be fixed. If we have like one or two key gasification plants to take our Texas LNG and convert it back into gas, they take out that one plant, it's done. It's a decade and billions of dollars to rebuild it. Whereas an LNG pipeline running from Russia to China costs nothing to maintain by comparison. When they lay a pipeline or they lay railroad tracks, every 10 miles, they just lay another half a mile of extra pipe and track. So if they ever need to, they fix it like overnight, no problem. So they're going to have some built-in advantages that we're not going to be able to easily overcome. Russia has even built a class of what they call super icebreakers. These are nuclear-powered, 50,000-ton. They make our 60-70-year-old icebreakers look like pathetic antique Tonka toys. These are brand new nuclear icebreakers that can go through 12 feet of ice, just plow through it, making a path 100 feet wide. They're going to be able to keep the sea lanes open above Russia year round. But who's going to be able to use that? Russia's friends, China, any countries that are on good terms with Russia. Well, Japan and Korea, they're going to want to use that shortcut. They're going to then, therefore, have a diplomatic reason to be on good terms with Russia, because only Russia's friends are going to have access to that. So this has been like a paradigm shift that's like huge. It's just colossal, where for a century and a half, Britain and then America, we've been the global hegemon through sea power, and we've always kept the Eurasian landmass from ever being a monolithic block. Now our sea power is being shredded, even though we don't see it yet. We're on the verge of an experience like what happened right after Pearl Harbor in Singapore. Two British battleships went out and were sunk in like a couple hours by Japanese two-engine land-based Betty bombers. At the time, the great thinking was no such aircraft could endanger a modern battleship because they've got 100 anti-aircraft guns. They've got a wall of flak, you know, a wall of AA fire. Don't worry, they're safe. They were sunk in like an hour. It was a huge paradigm shift. We're now decades past when aircraft carriers should have been seen as obsolete. We just haven't had that Singapore Pearl Harbor experience lately. So we're driving into the future with these obsolete behemoths, the aircraft carriers. But
we always fight the last war, Matt. You know that. We fight the last war.
This is like fighting the two wars ago. But the Houthis are trying to teach us in their own way. You can't just, you know, carry the big stick with carriers and battleships anymore, because any little coastal freighter could turn out to be the modern equivalent of a Q ship. And that cargo container suddenly opens up and pops a, you know, 40-foot long anti-ship missile at you. And we can't go around the world with X-ray glasses looking at every small coastal ship, fishing vessel, anything, not to mention seaborne drones that can be dropped off, mines, delayed action mines, delayed action torpedoes that have a linger factor where they can just sit on the bottom of a strait waiting for the propeller of an aircraft carrier to go by, you know, to be activated. These are things that only America, maybe France, Britain, Russia had 20, 30 years ago. But as Iran's shown us with drones, any technological nation can make these things now. And when American sea power is going to be shown to be basically a paper tiger, right? And we've pushed Russia and China together so that they're building pipelines and railroads, you know, netting their economies together. We're kind of on the back foot of history going into the next couple of decades. And what's it called? The Thucydides trap. You know, we're in that era where when one empire is coming to the end, it'll flail about and get into a big war very often. And I think that's what's going to happen. But these are not good days for the U.S. Navy. And I think we're seeing, like, you know, the end of one era and the beginning of another. But not many people in America understand it. And that's the real lesson of the Houthis in the Red Sea. Any little third tier country can threaten an aircraft carrier now, just by continuing to fire missiles. That's what I basically wanted to say tonight.
Well, I think there's let's talk the strategic of that too, because I think this is something that folks need to grapple with. We're not, the fight is not just going to be here on the ground. The fight's going to be global. And as we're going down and swirling the bowl, Russia and China are getting more and more capability and investing more and more. And the drone war that's occurred in the Ukraine should be a wake-up call for everybody.
Yeah, I'm sure our enemies have drone teams right here.
Absolutely.
Why wouldn't
they do? That's where I was going with that, Matt. And that they don't have to rely on all this heavy equipment anymore, or these big combat brigades to do a lot of damage. They can use drones to do it. If you've watched any of the film and any of the videos of the drone use in Ukraine, they're dropping hand grenades on people. You could drop a hand grenade on a power plant, take the whole damn thing down if you put it in the right place. And we have to assume that our enemies have that capability. More importantly, they have the training and they know exactly where our weak spots are. So,
and you can see our lack of imagination, because while this is going on and it's like, you know, everybody is studying drone warfare in Ukraine. If you go to Google Maps and switch to satellite view, and you could pick like dozens of bases at random. I used to live in Charleston, so I looked at one. Charleston Air Force Base, just Google that. And you'll see like 50 C-17 Globemasters parked virtually wingtip to wingtip. Each one costs $200 million, takes like, you know, 4 or 5 years to build. They were built over the last like 20 years. and they're parked wingtip to wingtip. That's a huge percentage of our global lift capability. In one night, some drone operator is going to land a thermite grenade on 50 different C-17 wings, burning through to their fuel tank and destroying a $200 million aircraft. And that they're not in hangars, they're just parked out in the open on revetments, wingtip to wingtip, like it's like we never, you know, like Pearl Harbor can't happen because we're in Charleston and everybody knows a war would happen over in Iraq or Saudi Arabia or the Middle East somewhere. A war could never happen in Charleston. We're safe. Just park our airplanes right out in the open. Yeah.
And they're not replaceable. That's the big part of this, right?
They're not replaceable.
Where this is angling towards, just so everybody's on the same page, is that when we lose the sea lines of communication, and we've already lost them, so let's just call a spade, that changes the paradigm for moving around the planet. But more importantly, it changes the way the logistics system is going to work. And it changes the way that they interdict the logistics system. If we're going around the Horn of Africa, that adds an extra week or two onto a trip. The same thing with the Panama Canal. And I know Troop can talk to this ad nauseum because he called the Panama Canal almost 3 years ago now. And I can tell you that this is going to impact everybody here in the States. The standard of living and the things you take for granted are going to come to an abrupt halt. And one of the things, traveling this week, one of the things that was a reminder for me is how blissfully unaware the public is. There's a vast part of the public that has no idea that any of this is going on. And I say that because this morning I caught about 5 minutes of CNN while I was watching, while I was eating breakfast. And I was astonished that the lead story was about Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez. And they all have their cute little names for them. But that's the lead story. It should tell you how much the population has been completely gaslighted to the bigger picture and how completely unaware most of the public is to the bigger strategic issues. And more importantly, the strategic shifts that have already happened that are going to impact our day-to-day life. But more importantly, our ability to sustain the lifestyles that people have right now. They have no idea how drastic of a lifestyle is going to change if the sea lines of communication can be shut down. That's going to be a shock to everybody.
The Russians, as a national characteristic, have like stubbornness and ability to endure pain are considered like national traits or qualities. Like the percentage of people that lost a grandfather, great grandfather in World War II in Russia is amazing. And the only comparison would be as if an enemy attacked America and burned every city from Boston to Washington to Pittsburgh, burned them to the ground, and a quarter of our population was killed. That would leave like and the rest were starved for years. We just had rationing and drives to find scrap metal, buy war bonds. But the our wars have always happened over there. Our guys get on airplanes, they go to the Middle East, and they come home. Most of them, some don't, or they have some physical or emotional scars. But by and large, Americans don't feel it. The supermarkets are full. At the height of the Vietnam War, height of the Korean War, our supermarkets are full. Buy a new car, everything's great. Yeah, it's tough for some soldiers, but it's way over there. It doesn't affect us. This is going to affect us when we can't supply our country with what we need. I mean, I just saw right now, today I heard China is cutting off certain strategic metals from America. Won't sell them to us anymore.
Yeah, they did that a few years ago. They're just expanding the list. And here's the kicker in that. We rely on titanium. They have the rights to that. Uranium was sold under Uranium One. So we've basically sold off all the strategic mineral rights that we've had. Yeah.
Under Bill Clinton, we closed our last big tungsten mine out on the California-Nevada border. And not only did we close that mine, we destroyed all of the infrastructure for the mine called the Sky High Mine, which was like, rails built on the side of cliffs. We destroyed all of that in for beautification purposes, meaning we could never reopen it. And then the Clinton sold off the strategic tungsten stockpile because they could do a quick bump in the GDP. Like, look at that. We just made money. Yeah, you just sold the strategic tungsten stockpile that we would need to build jet engines for a future war. They sold it to show like a profit on the books. I mean, that's the kind of strategic thinking we've got going on. Anyway, I'm sorry to.
Well, I think a better side of that, Matt, the bigger, more strategic side of that is it shows just how long that the elite have been working to dismantle the country. People look at all the changes, like when they moved the factories out of middle America and out of small towns, that wasn't because it was cheaper labor. They were doing it to slowly but surely destroy our manufacturing base. Because after World War II, all of our adversaries and all of our allies took note of one thing, and that was the massive production capability that we had in this country. It wasn't because of unions or cost. That's a bunch of nonsense. It was all to dismantle the country. And look at where we are now. If you fly over Wyoming, Texas, and a lot of the states in the center of the country, 33 states have natural gas rigs spidered throughout that countryside. Mm-hmm. And you're telling me that we can't produce our own fuel? We could switch to LNG right now and run everything on LNG and not break a sweat for decades. But yet we have to shut that down because it's toxic to the environment. It's all a scam, all of it. Everything they tell you is a scam. And they're trying to slowly but surely put us into a kill box, giving up the sea lines of communication. I can tell you that as a lieutenant, we spent days studying the sea lines of communication and the landlines of communication. So we understood exactly where the choke points were around the planet. So if we were ever in a situation where we were, you know, by ourselves in charge of that region, for whatever reason, we could make decisions that were based on how do we protect those sea lines of communication or landlines of communication. And now we've basically abandoned them, which means at some point in the future, they will be shut off.
Just the revolution in weaponry has had an important factor. It's an important factor too, because any 40-foot container or even 20-foot container on the back of a truck in any of these coastal regions adjoining any of the choke points. So it's not just a tramp steamer or a small freighter that turns out to have, you know, missiles in the container boxes. Any truck in a warehouse 5 miles from the coast can drive out of a warehouse and take a shot at a passing destroyer. I mean, this is something that's never happened before. Until recently, a destroyer passing through any of these straits to Japan pretty much felt invulnerable unless a Russian sub wanted to pop a torpedo off at it and start World War III. But who do you fire back at if in the Straits of Malacca, hiding in one of these hundreds of islands, a ship of unknown nationality fires a missile from a container at you? Are you going to go to war with Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines? Because anybody could have been controlling that little ship that'll just disappear after it fires its missiles. I mean, this is a fundamental paradigm shift that Americans have got to come to grips with. The sea power era is coming to an end. Meanwhile, Russia, China, Iran are locking up internal lines of communication. In fact, Russia is building something called the North-South International Trade Corridor to take a hypothetical container from Moscow to India in half the time that it takes a ship to go out of the Baltic, around the UK, through the Straits of Gibraltar, through the Red Sea, and then up the Indian Ocean to India. It's just going to get on a truck or a train, go to the Caspian, offload onto a ship that's essentially like a conveyor belt, the same way that the Panama Canal, a lot of the cargo going across the Panama Canal is not even going on ships anymore. A ship too big for the Panama Canal drops it at one side. In a matter of hours, it's unloaded onto trains like a conveyor belt, taken to the other side of Panama, on another ship. without having to pay the transit fees. So it's very efficient. That's what Russia is doing with Iran to connect the Russian market and northern Russia to Iran and India. This is an internal line of communication. There will never be a NATO ship on the Caspian. That's between Iran and Russia. That's their lake. And we've got nothing to do with it. We're like shut out of this thing now. So the tide is really turning and people have to come to grips with it. I hate to be, pessimistic sounding, but there it is.
Troop, I'm going to let you talk on this one because I know you got a lot of this.
What Matt's saying is absolutely true. We called that. So a lot of stuff stacked up in my brain right now. So let's work backwards. So for those of you that don't know, the Caspian Sea is basically south of the south and east of the Black Sea, right? Where you have Crimea, you got Russia, you got the Caspian Sea, you got China.
It's over to the east. It's over to the east.
Over to the east. I'm sorry.
It's between Iran and Russia.
So hold on, I gotta control my crazy dogs. Go outside, guys. I wrote a lot of threat assessments on that because there's a couple of reasons why. One of them was aerial surveillance or ISR, and the Caspian Sea itself, with the production capacity of China and the 2,000-mile long border with Russia or whatever, Russia doesn't have any embargo constraints that are viable. That's number one. And when I wrote that assessment on the Panama Canal 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I was saying, what about the Arctic Sea? And Matt's talking about these nuclear powered icebreakers. If Panama is compromised and we can't get traffic through, like, you know, from the Arabian Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, because we got Houthi rebels firing drones at us in the Red Sea, and the Chinese run our ports on the east and the west of the United States, the only place left is where this point of contention, which I think Iran, China, the United States, Russia, everybody's claimed some type of ownership over the Northern Sea. Well, the Northern Arctic Sea is a conquest sea, meaning if you don't have the technology, means, and capability to control it, you don't get to play there. And what Matt is saying is absolutely right. The Russians have been building sea fleets for years. They're like literally on the cutting edge of this, and they're going to absolutely be able to control that sea. And as soon as you start establishing shipping lines, that's one thing. You know, the U.S. Navy can't go up there right now. We don't have the capability. All we could do is really harass and intimidate them.
We can't go into the Russian Arctic Sea route at all because it goes through Russian territorial water. There are islands in the Arctic that the Russian northern route goes right through Russian territorial water. So they can just say only our friends can come. If we had super icebreakers, we could go over Canada. We haven't even created a design yet.
Well, that's the point I was trying to make is that it's one thing to have control over a sea lane and another thing to be in territorial waters or adjacent to territorial waters, but it's another thing to have the global clout to say, well, we crushed through this, you know, these sea lanes, and now we've established trading partners, and now we have international agreements with people that have a say in the G7 and in NATO and wherever. So, I mean, people are turning their backs on the United States left and right. And what I can share though is definitely the traffic in the Northern Arctic Seas is going to be the next big thing. Because we are, I mean, the worst thing that Jimmy Carter did, I think as a human being and a humanitarian, I have respect for President Carter, but he was obviously a shitty politician, and I don't know what he was thinking handing over Panama. We should have never given that up.
One of the most amazing things you'll see, look up Fort Clayton, Panama. It's by the locks on the Pacific side. Like, it looks at the locks on the Pacific side. It was the Army headquarters with the big American flag in front. Now it's running the UN invasion. It's got a big UN flag out in front.
Yeah, and Michael Yon has been, covering that quite a bit. But here's the thing. So let's roll back a ways. I wanted to put my foot on vehicles, and then I'll walk through this. So Kelly tires, Cooper tires. I'm with Matt. Those are the best tires. But I've run, BF Goodriches and Goodyear Wranglers, and I buy my tires off of Craigslist. I drive a Jeep Cherokee, now I drive a Jeep Wrangler, a Rubicon, and I never worried about the big tires. What I do is I go on Craigslist and I buy a set of five brand new tires from some kid that just bought a Jeep Wrangler and it has the same lug pattern. And then I get five brand new rims and five brand new tires that are usually like 32, 33s, whatever they come with, military Jeep size tires. And I've been running short, small, like 30 to 33 inch tires for 30 years. And I've ran it on like two wheel drive Ford Rangers and Nissan Frontiers and Cherokees and Jeeps. And
what year is your Rubicon?
2015.
So it ran Dana 40s stock, which can run up to a 35. They can support the weight of up to a 35 inch tire.
They do, but so what? Where I use four wheel drive is to get out of trouble, not get into it, and that's something where I mean I spend a lot of time off road, and the only time I'll put it in four wheel drive preemptively is if I have a really slick road and I got cliffs or you know like some kind of hazard over the side of the road and I want more control, but you know on mud and dirt and stuff, but I mean tires are expendable, so I was when we were running a lot, my buddy Sean and I were running a lot, we would go through like two or three tires every weekend. I mean, they were a commodity. I would buy them with like white showing on them. I didn't give a shit because we knew we were going to tear them up. So we would run them on like steel rims and just, you know, I got so good at changing tires. It's like Jeff Bodine's pit crew. No, you know, no big deal. But I never really overthought the vehicle. And I understand what you mean about transport. For me, transport, I want fast, light, small, quick. And as far as like the diesel goes, you know, not all of us are going to build the ultimate vehicle. But my wife's truck is a diesel, and so how we kind of did that was I know I could take an ice pick, you know, or even an AR round through a broken down vehicle fuel tank, and harvest a lot of diesel for a really long time. But the idea of thinking that the roads are going to be open, and I mean, there's all this calculus that comes along with this long range travel of a wheeled vehicle. If you have any kind of vehicle, it's fine. But, you know, I keep going back to my vehicle is my bug out bag, but the bag that I carry will fit in a 5-gallon bucket. And the bag that I carry with me, I carry every day. And the bag that I carry, a lot of the stuff that's in that bag, I already have in my cargo pockets, like my tourniquet, my little first aid kit, other stuff like that. So I take stuff out of my everyday carry bag and put stuff that's in my vehicle in that bag if I have to dismount and abandon the vehicle. So there's a lot to that. You know, traveling and just expecting that eventually you're going to be on foot, at least until you can commandeer another vehicle. But I mean, if you got anything that weighs more than, I would say even 20 pounds in a bag, you're not going to be using that. You're not going to be carrying it, but let's get with the Houthis. So the Yemeni people, when they had the original Arab Spring, I'm like, yeah, Yemen, right? Because they had kind of people were pissed off and they have a corrupt government. And the Yemeni people were the first ones to kind of light the whole Arab movement on fire. And I was really hopeful at that time that the tide was going to change in Yemen, and it didn't. And really, the way for people that aren't informed on that, the way to look at the Yemeni Houthi resistance against the United States and Israel. Is the Yemeni, the Houthi rebels are kind of like a proxy between like Saudi Arabia and Iran. And they are very much like how we have this Russian-Ukrainian war. We're fighting a proxy war with Russia through Ukraine. And the Houthis themselves, as Matt was saying, I think the Yemeni people, eventually they want peace. I think eventually they're going to modernize and they're going to become a first world class society. They're going to be a lot like the UAE at some point. That's my hope I have for them. It's a long road, but since they do have a hell of a lot of control and they can impose these missiles, these SAMAD-2 missiles, they have a 500 kilometer range, so they're like a 200 mile range, and the Red Sea is about 100 miles wide. So if you're looking at Yemen, it's aiming, you know, from the way that we look at the globe, it's aiming to the southwest, and you have the Red Sea that's like kind of coming up through the Arabian Sea. So you have the Arabian Sea, you have the Red Sea, and then it goes into the Gulf of Aden, and then you go through the not the Suez Canal, help me out, guys.
Suez Canal,
and then you have the Mediterranean Sea. So you have the naval power, you know, in the Mediterranean Sea and in the Arabian Sea. I'm aware of some technological developments that you guys will be aware of in the public domain. The drone thing isn't really going to be an annoyance in the coming years, but it is going to change a lot of technology that's on ships. But there's going to be anti-drone capability on small, merchant marine ships that will be deployable. It'll be a big industry, and you want to buy stock in it because obviously there's a need for it. But you got to think about how those SAMAD-2 missiles, they're Iranian designed missiles. And the reason why the Houthis are so successful at launching these attacks is because they're licensed, like the Russians, to assemble these drones in country. So they have the technology, they have the rule, schools, tools, capability, supply chain, and they're assembling these drones in country so they can assemble them at scale. The problem is they have to be within, I would say, effectively 20 miles of the shoreline to use them against merchant marine or any surface fleet vessels, but they could be out as far as 100 miles inland, and they could still control a major part of those seaways in the Red Sea. I don't think the Gulf of Aden is really a threat. They could launch some stuff in there, but I don't really see that being a high stress point for the Navy. But the problem is that you have to, in order to get through the Suez Canal, is you have to travel through both of those seaways, right? So they have a lot of power.
I'm not specifically speaking to the Houthi political situation. They could all find Jesus next week for all I care. My point isn't that. It's that the weapons revolution is making it you can say we're just going to deploy some anti-drone stuff. Sounds great. But swarms of drones are already able to overwhelm our own ships. Our ships have had to leave the area because they've got a limited number of $2 million standard missiles.
Yeah,
fired at $50,000 drones. Then so, they have to leave rearm.
So they're rapidly
rearm at sea. They have to go to a port and rearm vertically.
So there's rapidly developing technologies that are going to mitigate a lot of that, and a lot of the analysis of the drone.
Easy to say. Hopium.
I have an informed opinion on that, but the big difference
between the F-35 will sweep them from the sky. I've seen our technology. Come on.
I have nothing more to add then.
We'll see. But when containers are just launching missiles at ships from any of the straits around the world, are we going to just attack that country, assuming that some freighter somewhere belongs to Malaysia, Philippines, Indonesia?
Yes, we will.
And that will stamp it out? That'll stop it?
In the last four conflicts, how long were we there? 10 years? 10 years plus, almost 20 in Afghanistan. I mean, come on. The game is not about stamping it out. It's about a prolonged presence. I don't see a change in that strategy.
How did Iraq and Afghanistan work out for us?
It didn't.
In terms of blood and treasure.
Yeah. There's no end state there that ends with a victory, right? It's 20 years of sustained conflict with no end state.
At the view from the moon, The Eurasian supercontinent economy is emerging, and sea lines of communication, ability to pop in and disrupt and keep these people apart, is ending. And a lot of that is just the weapons. Things like torpedoes, anybody can build them now. That was something that was only America or Russia 20, 30 years ago. Anybody is capable of laying these things in straits around the world now, active mines and torpedoes that wait for a specific ship. I mean, this is not the super high tech that we used to have a monopoly on.
Well, I think there's two pieces, and somebody said it in the chat, is AI enabled autonomous drones are going to be the next wave of this, right? Well, there's already some of it that's been used on the battlefront. Some of it's been used in different locations around the world, but I think that's going to AI control drones will be the next part. Then dangerous part of that is going to be, how much that proliferates around the world and how fast, because that, I think I've talked about AI already and my fears about that, but,
including inside of America, including loitering drones that can park on a wall waiting to see a specific first person's face.
We already have that. Then, DARPA's had that for years.
Right. Like, but I mean, this is going, but it's not going to be, it's not going to be a notional, you know, hidden in a black room. It's going to be something that's actually put into use.
No, they have micro drones now that they use that they can basically park in a room. You never even see it, never even know it's there. You don't even look twice. And I think that's going to be the next phase of it, right? So we're coming up on an hour and a half here. Got about 10 minutes left. Let's wrap it up, do some closing comments, and then we can hit some of these next week. Because I think the move conversation we could carry over to next week. There's tons of topics there. I mean, just talking tires, what that's 20, 30 minutes that we spent on that. And that's a massive consideration. So who wants to start with closing comments? Don't everybody start at once.
Well, I'll just say, look, we're up against a big problem where, I mean, our desperation was shown by blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline and then lamely blaming on the Russians and then Ukrainians. We did that. We did that to keep Russia's natural gas from Germany's industry, which is just a paradigm for that entire emerging, you know, from Russia to China, and Europe is becoming left in the backwater, and with it, America, the Five Eyes, all which depended on sea lanes of communication being open, enforced by the US Navy, before that, the British. And that era is coming to an end. When we can't use the Panama Canal, when we can't use the Suez Canal, you know, it's going to be we're going to become a second tier global economy.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a dramatic shift in our posture when we lose our first carrier battle group, and it's going to happen.
Big time.
It's going to happen, and not that I want it to happen, but I mean, I just see it coming, and it's going to shift from our traditional enrichment of the military industrial complex as a way of warfare to actually fighting for our lives. And that's not something we're used to, not as a nation, you know,
hopefully we'll have leaders that want us to win.
Well, and that's a big question mark, isn't it?
Yeah,
we don't.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to push leaders forward that do want us to win. I mean, come on, we know how the game's going to be played. Let's just call a spade a spade. We can't, we're not relying on the current set of dipshits that are in office right now, the current set of morons that are in DOD. We're going to have to replace them. You know that as well as I do. And it's going to be during the fight. It's going to be during the chaos that we're going to have to do that. And I don't know how that's going to develop, but I can tell you that's already, sorry, to discussion point. And I'm not the only one that recognizes that. Finally, some senior people are starting to recognize that, yeah, we're going to have to replace this whole crew because they not only are they incompetent, but they're Marxist. So all that's going to happen all at the same time. I hate to say it.
I hope there is time. I mean, in the Civil War, you know, you could blow a year or two waiting to find your General Grant. This might be over before we ever find a General Grant.
Well, there's that. There's always that possibility. I don't get that sense. The sense I get is that as the situation develops, and at some point when that I'm telling you, law of unintended consequences. I keep saying it. I say it for a reason, because I know how ops goes. And they haven't hit the unintended consequences yet, but they will. And when they do, that's when you'll see the right moves happen. And it's still going to suck no matter what, but at least we'll see that happen. At least I get that sense. I might be wrong, but I doubt it. So there's a lot of variables there that could play out a lot of different ways. But the one thing we haven't seen yet is we haven't seen a major stumble. We've seen a few small stumbles, but we haven't seen the major yet. And I think we're about to see some of those major stumbles. I don't know why I say that. I just get this overwhelming sense that that's what's going on. So, Troop, I want you to finish your thought on countering tech, because you were talking about it. And I know that Boeing's working on it. I know Lockheed's working on it. I know a few others are working on it. So I want you to finish your thought on that before we wrap this up.
Well, I have nothing to add. Thank you.
Okay. Matt Everett, you want to do closing comments?
Yeah. You know, get yourself more prepared tomorrow than you are today. And work out a working list. You know, we used to have what were known as battle rhythm calendars, where, you know, or the road to war, in some units they were called. You know, you have a train up cycle to your next deployment. We don't have a finite date, right? But, you know, whereas we did when I was in, like, okay, this is your deployment date. These are all the tasks that you need to have done. Your training calendar and, you know, everything done by this time. But you need to have a 7-day, a 14-day, a 30-day, a 60-day, a 90-day, 120-day calendar written out of goals of things that you need to have. And you need a budget for them. You know, yeah, I'm in the business of night vision, thermal deal. You know, I'm a dealer for all that equipment, right? But you need to understand something. I got into that business because I understand how important it is. I could have very easily taken, you know, what I made off of my books, which have done incredibly well, right? And just went home with it and said, I'm not going to do anything else for the community, right? I'm just going to profiteer off of it. I'm going to go home, whatever, right? That's not why I wrote my books. That's not why I do what I do. That's not why. That's not who I am. That's not what I am, right? I built it into a business. I built it to offer you the best. Literally, by the way, the best equipment that you can get at the best prices you're going to be able to find. Period. End of story. And, you know, I get bombarded with emails all the time. Oh, well, that's too expensive. Period. Hey. Either you get it or you don't. Like, the technology is what it is, right? So we've got a lot in stock. I'm working on getting more. I'm out in Texas right now teaching. It's going to be a gigantic class. I've got over 30 people in it. It's going to be huge. And for the remainder of the year, we're booked up like this. But everything that's not in stock right now, we're going to have in stock by the end of next week. I'm working on that. I've got some phone calls that I've got to make for a couple of the manufacturers that are out there tomorrow morning. I'm going to have everything in. A lot of people have been clamoring for the 256 thermals, but I want to get back to what I was saying about budgeting for stuff, and it's training goals, right? Budgets are training goals too. Understand this. You know, you put aside a certain amount of money and say, okay, you know, I'm going to discipline myself and I'm going to work up to this goal. I know that this thing is cost this much. You know, I know this benchmark of performance requires me to do this, right? I need to be able to run 2 miles in, you know, 15 minutes or whatever. It's, you know, 7 minutes, 30 seconds per mile. Anybody should be able to do that, right? You know, I'm going to go out and ruck 6 miles and, you know, hopefully you can do that in an hour and a half. Simple things, right? These are all training goals that you need to work yourself up to. A budget needs to be part of that as well, right? And then finally, you know, getting formal training, that's huge. You know, obviously I offer that. You can find the schedule on brushfeeder.store. Kay's got that. I don't want to steal any of his thunder, but, you know, he's got that at combatstudiesgroup.blogspot.com. You know, and as I said on Twitter earlier, or X, or whatever we're calling it this week, earlier today, you know, he offers the most important courses I think you can take as a civilian, and that's the ground rod courses. You know, you need to get in on those, period. You know, before you ever take a class with me or anybody else out there, or like the firearms courses or any of that, before any of that, you need to get into ground rod courses, period. Because how, you know, what's our most common avenue that we access information out there? It's via the internet. That's how you're doing it right now, right? that's what ground rod's built around. And so, you know, how not to get killed on that, how to better use that stuff. Questions that, that, you know, a lot of you out there have, those are in the class, and it teaches you, you know, that, that right there is a training value alone, but there's so much more to that course that you need that applies to a lot of domains. And so, you know, with that said, there you go.
Chris,
thanks for that endorsement. Hey, before I forget, Trooper and Colonel Murray have graciously invited me down to Phoenix to do a course. And they've done a lot of legwork making that happen. That'll be September 10, 11, and 12. It's Gunfight Concepts. And I think we've got a few seats left on that. So if anyone's interested, they can reach out to me on that.
How do they get a hold of you, Chris?
So the website is combatstudiesgroup.blogspot.com. I'll put it in the comments as well. Or comstugroup@protonmail.com as far as email.
And I'll be at that course 10 through 12. And it's 3 days of training. It's not show up one day, go home, and show up the next day. It's three straight days of training. And I'll be at that training. And so will Troop.
Unfortunately, I'm going to be the range master on that because Teddy is on assignment. So when Chris and I open up the range, I have to do those, you know, the rules and everything, and then hand it over to Chris. And then I just, I don't get to play. I only get to observe. So I'm really, really disappointed about that.
But if you can come out for it, that's the best time to come out. It's still going to be hot. Let me just warn everybody. It's still going to be damn hot down here. But it's worth your while.
And we have barrels, so please don't shoot the barrels. The barrels are considered innocent non-combatants on the course. So
anything else, Chris?
No, that's all I got.
Troop?
No, the course, I think, what can you confirm the number of instructor to student ratio? And you're going to be the only one out there, and I don't think we have anybody else has experience on that course that can assist you. So what's the anticipated student amount that you can have on the range?
We'll probably cap that at 12.
Okay. And then where are we at now? I think
some of those bays are kind of narrow too, so we can't get too many.
So yeah, Teddy and I, when we do pistol courses, if we have more than 12 students, we'll run sets. So, you know, like run a drill and then run another drill. And the people that are going to that course, we can trust to top off their magazines on the red line while we have people forward on the firing line. So that's something that we do have control over. So if we have a lot more flexibility than having to bring everybody back to the range line, clear and elevate and all that. So, you know, we have a pretty permissive range. So the narrowness, if we get over 12, you have another instructor, we might be able to, we have a little bit more flexibility on that, but 12 to 14 is a good amount. So I'm excited. I'm really excited for this.
Yeah. If we get dogpiled on, I've got a Delta buddy I can fly out. So we'll be in good shape.
And the cost of the course is $1,000, right?
$850.
So put it on your calendar, and if you can make it out, that's a good time to come out. So I highly recommend it. And look, you'll see that your skills will atrophy. I know mine have. So part of this course will be, as I've told Chris 100 times, unfucking the old man's bad habits. So, you know, that's going to be a part of the course, and it's anyway, I think it's going to be very beneficial if you guys can make it out. So,
do it while you can.
Yep.
Oh, one more thing on that. M193 only or frangibles. We can't, and that's only because we don't want to poke holes in the steel targets that are downrange. So you guys signing up, It's 500 rounds minimum of rifle, 500 rounds of pistol, and just a 55 grain can, no 62 grain green tip, and only so we don't poke holes in the you can use that ammunition on that range, but I don't think that Colonel Murray and Chris want to have Swiss cheese plates when they head out.
No, and I'll have some extra boxes of 5.56 ball, 55 grain out there, range stuff that we can use if you don't bring ammo with you. Okay, you know, I've got a couple of admin notes to wrap up with. First one is the link for the One Team, One Fight shirts that everybody was asking me about. That's in the description. You can hit the spread shop and order the shirts. The design's finally right. For those of you who had to do a credit, hopefully everybody was able to credit it and replace their shirt with the right design. Spreadsheet made that right. So far, I've heard that almost everybody has gotten their shirts replaced. If you haven't, let me know. And then don't forget about the course 10 through 12. That'll be the three of us will be out there. And last but not least, I want to talk about very quickly about the Democratic Convention. I put a note in Telegram today because I was getting a bunch of questions about it. Here's my view of the Democratic Convention. It was all smoke and mirrors. The protests outside were controlled protests. It was all smoke and mirrors. It was just distraction. And I say that for two reasons. Number one, they didn't burn anything down. If they were serious about protesting Palestine, then that would have gone viral across the country, and it hasn't. It hasn't got any traction. Only paid actors are the ones that have been doing most of the protesting, and they didn't do anything like the Floyd riots. If they were serious, this would have been like the Floyd riots, and they would have been seriously trying to burn down that DNC convention. It was smoke and mirrors. And my conjecture on that is that they were trying to keep the distraction away from Harris because they didn't want any challenges on the floor. And that there's a lot of politics around it. There's a lot of noise around it. But at the end of the day, it's all smoke and mirrors. I didn't pay attention to it. And you shouldn't either. The proof is going to be in the next couple of months what happens to Trump, what they do with messaging related to Harris and how they handle her campaign. Don't expect her to debate Trump. They don't have to do that. In fact, Mike Ferris did an interview with somebody that made a very succinct point about it. Can't remember the guy's name, Mike, but watch that interview because she's running the same campaign that Biden ran, and they're using AI. They're using a lot of other things to make it seem like her crowd size is bigger, but it's not. So don't get wrapped up in that. That's all narrative, every bit of it. The thing to pay attention to is what we've been talking about tonight. Set a budget, make a list, identify the things you don't have, use the gear you have, replace the things you can while you can. I can tell you that things are getting way more expensive. And if you don't have ammo, buy ammo now, because it is going to be a very, very precious commodity. And it's also barter material. So keep that in mind. And the last thing is lose the fear. There's nothing to be scared of. This is going to develop the way it develops. We're here. We're all here for a reason. We're all here in this time for a reason. So use that time, live your life, and lose the fear. We'll be back tomorrow night with the audio roundtable. God bless everyone. One team, one fight.
Go on.